The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Anne May Chang, author of Lean Impact, How to Innovate for Radically Greater Social Good, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
The social sector, with some notable exceptions, has approached solving problems in very much the same way for decades now. And while that approach has yielded some significant wins, it no longer seems to be up to the task for dealing with the scale of today's problems. So, importing some of the best practices, such as the lean startup movement from business, making the right accommodations to fit the social sector, seems like a pretty good idea. And the woman pioneering that idea is with us now. She is Anne May Chang, the executive director of Lean Impact and the author of Lean Impact, How to Innovate for Radically Greater Social Good. Good evening, Anne May, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Before we get into the Lean Impact movement, it would be helpful if you would tell us about the Lean Startup movement, how it began, and what is the theory at the center of it.
Sure, my pleasure. So the Lean Startup movement was started by Steve Blank and Eric Ries with the idea of helping. It started out in Silicon Valley with the idea of helping entrepreneurs build better products that people actually wanted and needed. Startup companies work with a lot of uncertainty. They're generally building things that no one has ever done before. And what we found is that in traditional software development, people would have to build software and ship it in boxes on floppy disks. And so you'd have to plan everything well in advance, spend a lot of time, designing and then building your product, testing your product, and then shipping it and hoping it was something people wanted. The result was a lot of times we ship products that didn't really hit the mark. And so with the advent of the web and cloud computing, we're now able to get products out much more quickly. And so the Lean Startup now is giving us some tools based on the best practices that have developed out of Silicon Valley to learn, iterate, and improve our products much faster and eliminate the waste that can be involved in heading down the wrong path and building the wrong products that people don't really want.
You know, there are some words and phrases, Anne May, that are used so commonly and in so many different contexts that they've almost lost their meaning. I think social entrepreneur would be one, but innovation would be another. How do you define or describe innovation?
Yeah, I think innovation is probably one of the most overused and most misunderstood words in the English language these days. I think a lot of people think of innovation as that big idea or the transformative technology that's going to change everything. And, you know, Edison said that genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration.
Right.
And I think that that holds for innovation, too. That 1%, in my mind, is the invention or the big idea. Absolutely essential, but far from sufficient. I think of innovation as that 99%, the sort of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into testing a solution, refining it, figuring out how it's going to work in different contexts, building out the infrastructure, and actually getting it to practical application to make a real difference in the world.
Yeah. And you maintain that innovation for social good is actually harder than innovation for business. Why do you say that is the case?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons that innovation is harder in the social sector. Just to name a few, the biggest one that always comes up is funding. If you think about in business world, you're usually selling your product to a customer who is then buying your product. And so there's a very tight feedback loop. If you build a product that or service that your customer doesn't want, they're not going to buy it. So you learn right away. So you can learn very quickly. And that's really at the core of innovation. In the social sector, often the person paying for your product or service is not the person receiving it. And so you have a much more, you have two customers you have to deal with, which makes your feedback loop much more complicated. But it also, you know, means that they may have different agendas. Your funder may have different priorities than what your beneficiary actually needs. Funders also can be very restrictive in the kind of place a lot of restrictions on the grants that they give so that they require you to do a lot of planning up front in your proposal and then expect you to execute on that plan, you know, very faithfully through the duration of the grant. And that also makes innovation difficult. There's many other challenges. You know, certainly, you know, measuring e-commerce transactions is much easier than measuring social impact. You know, social impact impact can take months or years to fully realize. And experimenting with people who may be in vulnerable situations takes a lot more care. So these are just a few things, but I think there's a number of different elements that makes innovating in the social good space much more difficult.
Yeah. And before we get to Lean Impact, it might be helpful if you would tell us how projects happen in the social sector or in global development now, and what are some of the shortcomings you've identified of this approach?
So I think across the social sector, this is a gross generalization because certainly there is a range, but there's a tendency to plan based on constraints rather than plan based on needs. Mm. And by constraints, I mean you have a certain budget, certain staff, certain grant that you're applying for that has a certain time duration, and you think, what can I do with what I have or what I might be able to get in a grant? And so we tend to think small. Another thing that's common in the social sector is that when you get grants, usually, and even if you get individual donations, people are looking for short-term results as mm-hmm. soon as possible. How many people are you reaching? What are you delivering? And people tend to be fairly risk-averse. They want to see what their dollars are doing right away. And so there's a real pressure to deliver, and there's a lot of hesitation to take risks that are necessary to be able to innovate.
Well, the Lean Impact approach is in contrast to some of that. So there are three core guiding principles, and I'm going to ask you to say a word about each if you would. The first is to think big. We need to be bold. Speak to that.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, we tend to think too small in the social sector. We tend to think within the constraints that we have, and the needs are tremendous. You know, a lot of times, even the most successful nonprofits and social entrepreneurs are hitting only a tiny fraction of the need that exists in the world. You know, when I worked in Silicon Valley, what we found is like every entrepreneur is out there with their hockey stick graphs, projecting how they're going to hit a billion people. And I think we should have some more of that ambition when it comes to social good, because it's absolutely needed.
Yeah.
And so the first principle of Lean Impact is to think big, to really be more audacious in the goals that we set. Because if we don't set a goal that's audacious, there's no reason to take the risk to try to get there. Just as an example of that, one of the social entrepreneurs I highlight in the book is Ben Mangan.
Of Earn.
Of Earn, yeah. He started a social enterprise called Earn that was helping Americans develop a habit of savings, particularly low-income Americans. And Earn, several years ago was really lauded in the sector for being one of the most successful because they had 7,000 people that they were helping build a habit of savings. But one day, Ben woke up and he was thinking, there's 200 million people out there that could benefit from something like this. And we are reaching such a small fraction, and we're not going to get anywhere close on the path that we're on. So at an awards dinner, he actually stood up and made this audacious pledge to say, we're going to reach 1 million people in 5 years. And that was, so far and above what they were doing today. It required them to completely rethink their model. They were previously, doing in-person visits, doing matching grants, and that just wasn't going to be possible if you're going to scale to 1 million people. So instead, it pushed them to develop an online platform where they could reach a lot more people a lot more quickly and a lot more scalably.
Yeah, and when you get audacious like that, you get people excited. One of my favorite expressions is, if you're having trouble rolling a small rock up a hill, go find yourself a bigger rock.
I love that.
Because you do get people excited, and as you say, you find different strategies that you're forced to take. Now, this is a little counterintuitive, your second point, because if we need to think big, you suggest we start small. Now, why would you want to do that if you want to think big?
That is a little bit counterintuitive, but for many things that we do today, we have a tendency to think too small and start too big because of this pressure to deliver and show results. Mm. I would argue that if we want to get big, if we want to scale to reach massive numbers of people, and we want to dramatically increase our impact, we need to experiment. We need to learn. We don't have the answers. And the best way to experiment is to start small. When you're only working with 5 or 10 or 100 people, it's much faster and much cheaper to be able to test something out, to learn something, and to iterate. It's also much easier to be responsible about making sure you're not having unintended consequences. And when we start too big and we roll out things to too many people, it can really slow down that learning process because we're spending all our time and money just running things instead of learning. So I think the key in innovation is the speed of your learning cycle, that the faster you can learn, the faster you can innovate.
And the final core principle is to relentlessly seek impact. What's the secret to that?
Well, you know, in business, the structure of business is such that everyone is trying to maximize shareholder value. It's built into our laws and regulations. And what I think is essential is that we figure out how to have that same relentless focus on impact when it comes to social good. There's so many things that can lead us astray, whether it is, you know, we have a particular technology that we're excited about, or a particular role for our organization that we're trying to push, or a particular, you know, press release we're trying to make, or just a solution that we're really wed to. And so I think part of making innovation successful is trying to figure out how do we create the systems within our sector such that everyone that is working towards social good is really focused on the trade-offs that maximize social good versus one of these other things that may distract us.
Yeah, and in the book, Anne May, you differentiate between vanity metrics and innovation metrics. What's the difference?
So vanity metrics is a term that Eric Ries coined in the Lean Startup. And what he calls vanity metrics are things like the number of people we reached or the number of dollars we raised. If you think about that, you can reach a lot of people and you can raise a lot of dollars and not actually be doing any good, right? You could, you know, have trained a number of people, but they may not have done anything different as a result or had their lives improved as a result. And I would argue that even if you train people and as a result their lives are better and you have some great stories to tell, it doesn't necessarily mean that the money that you spent in doing so couldn't have been better spent by somebody else. They maybe could have trained twice as many people or gotten twice as good results. And so that's why we call those vanity metrics. And they sound good. They're the kinds of things that most nonprofits have on their websites is, you know, this is how many people I've reached. This is how many lives I've touched or improved. But I don't think they're that meaningful. And so what's meaningful are what Eric calls actionable metrics, or I call innovation metrics, which are the usually at the unit level. So for every 100 people we train, how much money are we spending? How many of them are having their lives improved? How many of them are telling their friends and family and having them referring them to us because they were so compelled by what we created? You know, what's the conversion rate? When we optimize on these unit metrics, you know, and reduce the costs, increase the yields, increase the success rates, then as we scale, we can magnify the impact that we have.
Yeah. So it sounds to me that if you're in for the long game, you need those innovation metrics. If you want the short game, go for the vanity metric.
Exactly.
But they're going to get hit a dead end pretty soon. You also advise that people love the problem and not your solution. Speak to that a little bit, and how can it help change the approach?
Yeah, I think in the social sector, there's a real tendency to fall in love with our solutions for a number of reasons. You know, almost any solution will do some good. You know, we will always have a story where it helps someone in their life that's really tangible, and so we can become emotionally attached to that solution. We don't want to let it go. A solution is also the thing that we identify with. It's what we every day, you know, pump ourselves up to go out to funders, whether institutional funders or individual donors, and tell them how great our solution is. And it's the best thing since sliced bread. And so it's easy to drink your own Kool-Aid and get really, you know, attached to your solution. But what I think is important is to stay focused on the problem. And because no solution is perfect, and as we, if we stay focused on the problem and really look at the data, it'll tell us whether our solution is working or not. And if we're honest with ourselves and we pay attention to that data, we need to be willing to let go of our solution if it turns out to not be the best solution. Sometimes that may be a slight tweak to our solution. Sometimes it may be a more major pivot. Sometimes it may mean taking a completely different path altogether.
Yeah. So it's sort of strong convictions loosely held.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's put this all together. And a wonderful example of an organization that has embraced the lean impact approach is Summit Public Schools out in the Bay Area. Walk us through what they did and what the results were.
Sure. You know, education is one of those areas that's notoriously difficult to innovate because the feedback loops can be very long. It takes a long time. Summit Public Schools' initial goal was to have their students, 100% of their students, graduate from college. Now, you can imagine, you know, it takes 8 years to get someone from junior high to college. And when their first class got to college, they were really pleased to see many of them were graduating from college, but not 100%. And so, you know, but because the rates had increased so much, a lot of people were coming and saying, hey, this is a great model. You should scale. And I really admire the founder of Summit Public Schools, Diane Tavener, because she said, no, you know, this is good, mm-hmm. but it's not good enough. We can do better. But we need to find a faster way to figure out how to improve, because we can't wait another 8 years to figure out if we've gotten it right. And so she actually had gotten a copy of Eric Ries's book, The Lean Startup, mm-hmm. and started looking at how do we do this within the context of education. And the short version of it is that they were really focused on this notion of personalized learning. And they started running week-long experiments where they would try different configurations of, you know, mixing individualized coaching and personalized learning and project time, and looking at what the mix of interventions was that was most effective. And each week they would look at the data. They would look at assessment scores. They would look at feedback from the students. They would have focus groups, and they would look at what was working well. And then they would do something different the next week. And they actually spent 57 weeks on this kind of these different iterations to really refine their methodology. And, you know, I think they've come up with something that is revolutionary and has been very successful in their schools. And now they've branched out, you know, so they're really now trying to scale. They started out in their own charter schools, mm-hmm. but now they're working with public schools, and they've now trained, I think, over 300 teachers from over 300 different public schools across 40 states who are now adopting this model and really bringing it to scale.
Yeah. That is fast. 1 week trials and then moving on to another one. And, you know, you mentioned there about listening to the feedback that they were getting, and that's so important because I've always found nonprofit organizations, we focus on the donor, we focus on our board, we listen to experts all the time in terms of what's the latest research, but often the last person we speak to are the beneficiaries. And it's been very encouraging to see this movement gain traction around beneficiary feedback and constituent voice. Why is it good for organizations to think of their beneficiaries as customers?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential. I think historically there has been a tendency, and even the word beneficiary is a little bit questionable, mm-hmm. right? It feels very patronizing
in a way.
But I don't know of a better word. I mean, I think customer is a great word, but it's sort of...
I think constituent voice is a good word.
That's another great word. So I think there's a number of reasons. First of all is, you know, if we're really trying to improve people's lives, we need to understand the realities of their lives and what works in their context. A lot of times, one of the other reasons that innovating for social good is harder is often the customers or beneficiaries we're working with have very different experiences than our own. Mm-hmm. And so our natural instincts can just be off. And so we need to understand what it is that their experience is like, especially, you know, when I was in global development at USAID and we're working with people who are in far-off countries with very different cultures living in very different circumstances, our assumptions can just be completely wrong. And so listening to them as customers can make sure that we are providing something that they value. So we're not giving them things that, you know, that just sit on the, you know, that they receive because it's free and they're happy to take, but they make no use of because it doesn't fit into their lives. But instead, we're really listening to them and seeing what is it that they need, how will they use it, and how can we design this to be of the most benefit to them? Because at the end of the day, if your beneficiary customer doesn't want what you're giving them, you're very unlikely to have a very big impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why sometimes I think when I look at these revenue models for nonprofit organizations, it makes sense. Because if you're getting some of your money from that stream, it really is basically saying people want this product. And if it's all philanthropy, you're really never sure, you know? So I think it can be a good litmus test for you. Well, let's say we do some lean impact. We get some great results. You know, one of the hardest things to do in the social good sector is to scale. Matter of fact, I had Doug Galen on the show of RippleWorks recently. He's created an entire organization about scaling social good. How do we need to think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think of all the different challenges in the social goods sector, scale is probably the biggest one in my mind. One of the problems is I think that we often look at scale as an afterthought.
Mm.
That, you know, we go out, we have an idea for a solution, we test it, we pilot it, we see if it works. And when we get to the point that we've run a pilot and we have some data that shows, hey, this is actually working, then we think, okay, now how are we going to scale this thing? And I would say it's too late at that point, because the path that you're going to take to scale, whatever model you're going to adopt to scale, has to be built in from the start. Now, think about if you're going to charge someone for your product, you can't run a whole pilot and give that product away for free and then say, okay, now we're going to start charging for it, because people may not buy the product. And or they, the price point at which you have to have the product for people to be able to afford it is going to be very different. So you have to design a whole different product or service. Or if you want government to be able to adopt something, you know, they're going to have different requirements, both in terms of budget, in terms of footprint, in terms of how the processes work. And so I think your path for scale really needs to be tested from the beginning, just like you're testing things like whether you're something you're customer wants and whether it has the impact that you're looking for.
So build an organization not for where you are, but where you want to be.
Exactly. I think the whole idea of lean impact is to, you know, start small and test early and often along the dimensions of value, growth, and impact to ensure that we have all the elements that are necessary before we kind of make bigger investments to take us forward that may be misdirected.
Let's get back to funding and the challenges inherent in that. So much of the social sector is dictated by grant makers. And if a nonprofit wants to get the money, they need to comply to the guidelines if they're going to be eligible. What things could grant makers do that would help create greater lean impact?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things that grant makers do, and I think there's a number of things that nonprofits can do who are applying for grants. One of the things that we did at USAID to really encourage innovation is to use a form of tiered funding for a program that we call DIV, or Development Innovation Ventures. It's modeled after venture capitalists, right, where we will, in the early stages, give out lots of small grants so we can place many, many little bets and take greater risk on those bets because they're small. And then we look and see of signs of traction, right, on those innovation metrics. Are they starting to show that this solution really has legs, really has promise? And for the ones that do, then we can increase our investment. So rather than making a big bet up front and trying to choose among 100 different options and trying to perfectly choose the right one, by using this tiered funding mechanism, we can try a lot more different things and then double down on the ones that work and then double down again as they continue to work. And so it allows for both more flexibility, which is essential for innovation, and more risk-taking, which is also essential for innovation. Mm-hmm. I think as you get to the later stages of innovation, looking for ways that grant makers can start paying more for outcomes than for activities is another way to support innovation. So if you are paying for outcomes, and it doesn't have to go to the extreme of a social impact bond, but if you're just even having bonuses based on outcomes or a part of your grant being outcomes-driven, it can encourage a social entrepreneur to increase their cost effectiveness, because then, you know, they can make more money, they can be able to do more good. So I think there's a number of tools like this that grant makers can use to encourage risk-taking and incentivize innovation.
You know, Amy, I can see how a startup nonprofit or a young organization can really embrace lean impact. But what about existing organizations? It can be very difficult to change the way you've operated for many years and the way you go about doing things. What advice would you have for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's always easier to innovate in a small startup than it is in a big organization. I think that holds true in business as well. I've seen a number of different things work. For many large organizations, they start out with an innovation team or lab where they try to cordon off and let them play under a slightly different set of rules, give them a little bit more flexibility. And that allows the organization to get started, get their feet wet, show some successes, and show the potential. So I think that's a good tool to get started. A bigger challenge is how do you mainstream that, because nonprofit organizations don't have complete control over their priorities, because a lot of it is also driven by their funders as well. And so part of that involves a negotiation with funders. One thing that I advocate nonprofits consider is actually pushing back on funders a little bit, right? You know, not being mean about it, but, you know, encouraging.
Not being beggars either.
Yes, exactly. but being willing to go back and say, we think we could do this better if you give us a little bit more flexibility, or we found this way to do it better. You know, one way to do that is to, in a proposal, potentially, you know, have a small slice. You know, 95% is exactly what the grant maker was requesting, but maybe 5% is like an innovation fund that allows you to run some experiments to figure out how you can do that 95% more cost effectively. And if in that 5% you even figure out a way to make it 10% better, it overall is going to pay off. And that seems like a hard proposition for a grant maker to take down.
Yeah.
To turn down.
Yeah, and it would seem like the foundations are going to be used to that 95-5 model, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. One other thing I was going to say is I believe that the breeding ground for innovation starts with a big goal. If you have an audacious goal that's measurable that you take on, like sending a man to the moon, that you just can't achieve with business as usual, mm-hmm. that's where innovation starts to kick in, right? That, it, you know, in a large organization, I've seen a lot of large organizations say, okay, now we want to innovate. Everybody innovate. We're going to send you to this innovation workshop. We're going to, you know, talk about innovation. But when they go back to their desk, what they're rewarded on is still the same things. They're still rewarded on, you know, successfully applying for grants and successfully executing on grants. And so if you have goals that are achievable with business as usual, there's no reason to take those risks. But when you start setting stretch goals for individuals and organizations that require you to do something different, then you need to start taking the risks, and it starts a whole cycle of at least having the incentive and the reason to be able to innovate.
And what would you say, Anne May, to those organizations who are going to say, what if we fail? What if we don't make our goal? Will that kill our funding? What would you reply to them?
Well, for larger organizations, I certainly wouldn't bet the farm on any one thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
That's the idea of placing these small bets, and that's the importance of starting small, is that when you innovate, when you take risks, there is a good chance some of those things will fail. But I would also argue that if we're trying to tackle a problem that is where we don't have a solution that's nearly sufficient, it's irresponsible for us not to take risks to find a better solution.
Mm-hmm.
I liken it to like thinking about, are we trying to empty the ocean with a spoon? Right? That if the need is so great out there and all we're doing is trying to scoop little teaspoons out of the ocean, we should be thinking about building a bigger spoon or mm-hmm. building a bucket.
You know, in addition to an audacious goal, in the companies or organizations you profiled in your book, were there any common threads in the workplace culture, the corporate culture, that made those organizations ready for lean impact? And anything specific if that comes to mind?
Well, I think the biggest one is that audacious goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that the organizations that are the most innovative are the ones that recognize, like I talked about with EARN, that the need is so much greater than they're able to reach with what they're doing today. And so thus it forces them to really stretch themselves. And that's the starting point of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I think another piece of it, though, is the agility, you know, that the willingness to take risks, to be agile, to be humble and recognize we don't know all the answers.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Anne May. You know, in a sector that is becoming increasingly blurred with purpose-driven businesses and B Corps, hybrids of every shape and kind, LLCs and not foundations, where do you see the sector going in the next decade, and what role do you foresee Lean Impact playing in taking it there?
Yeah, I think you're totally right. As I've gone out in the process of writing this book, I interviewed over 200 different organizations, really without a filter. I asked people I knew, the smartest people I knew, what were the best organizations they knew about and talked to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that many of the most interesting, most innovative, most impactful organizations are some sort of hybrid. They're no longer your traditional pure nonprofit, but neither are they your traditional pure for-profit. They're somewhere in between. And sometimes organizations that look almost like each other, like a One Acre Fund and Baba Ngona, who both work with smallholder farmers in Africa, one is a nonprofit and one is a for-profit, and they're doing very similar kinds of work. And so I truly believe that as we look forward, that more and more of the interesting work is going to happen in this hybrid space,
mm-hmm.
because there just isn't enough grant funding for us to reach the size of the need that exists in the world. And so we're going to need better tools, both for organizations to organize themselves as well as for funders to fund these types of organizations, to be able to draw from different types of funding, to blend, if you will, philanthropic capital with investment capital to be able to meet the needs of these kinds of hybrid organizations. And in terms of the role of Lean Impact, you know, I am hoping that Lean Impact will become a movement, just as Lean Startup did today in Silicon Valley. Even many people who haven't read the Lean Startup book know the concepts,
mm-hmm.
and they're injected in the way they do their work. If you're not, you know, taking the lean startup approach, people kind of look at you a little funny, right? Because it's, you know, lean impact and lean startup are not rocket science. You know, they're both based on the tried and true scientific method, right, of, you know, hypothesis-driven experimentation. And it's, you know, it makes common sense, but it's not something that is always done because of a lot of the pressures that exist. And so my hope with lean impact is that it will shift our mindset to ask the question, before we make these big investments, can we do some smaller experiments that can help us learn, help us get to the best answer as quickly as possible and as inexpensively as possible?
Think big, start small. Well, Anne Mae Chang, the executive director of Lean Impact and the author of Lean Impact, How to Innovate for Radically Greater Social Good, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, people know how to buy a book, but what about your website? Tell us about that.
Yeah, if you want to learn more, go to www.leanimpact.org.
Thanks, Anne Mae. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.